It's hump day, and I'm thirsty for baseball talk like a camel. Morning, Jordan.
Just like a camel, yes, we have some baseball to talk about. Jake and I attended some Major League Baseball games this week. What a thrill that was. We're going to talk about the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Mets and maybe the Blue Jays. We got some spice out in San Diego. We have some wild college baseball news, and we are going to talk about the Home Run Derby on this episode of Baseball Barbercast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world that prefers the Quiznos series to the Subway series. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And I like my baseball moving very slowly under an oven until it gets crispy.
Good shout out there. We have tried to jam in as many brand names as possible on recent episodes for basically no reason. It's great to see you, Jake. It is Wednesday. We are both at our own homes. Oh my gosh, I didn't even know this was allowed. We've been all over the place. I was in Boston earlier this week. I am going to talk about my experience at Fenway Park, self-described America's most beloved ballpark. We'll let that, you know, stay, you know, that can be debated. We're going to talk about your experience in the Subway Series. Some interesting stuff happening between the Padres and Nationals, an unlikely rivalry brewing? Juan Soto's not even there, but it did feel like he was sort of looming over it. We're going to have some home run chatter in the second half of this show, Jake. Both looking forward to the Home Run Derby, and finally, we've teased it recently, it is time for the first edition of Why Haven't You Homered Yet? We also are going to sprinkle in some college baseball news, because that is really where the spice can be found. But lots to get to, Jake. Where would you like to begin?
I would like to begin on the 7 train, which is not how I got to Citi Field last night.
Fraud.
I drove.
Fraud.
I know. Look, it's it's an hour quicker for me. I don't hate. The Mets and Yankees play.
Yeah.
They play 4 times a year now. Whenever they play, it is an event, because the people in this city have to go to work every day and hear about the other team from the fans that they sit next to at the office by the water cooler. The proximity provides the spice. And what I really like about this rivalry is there is a big brother, little brother component embedded in it, right? That's inevitable. The Yankees are the Yankees. Their aura is unmatched. They are the superior baseball team. They are the most popular team, the most popular brand. And the Mets under Steve Cohen have been trying to crawl to that level of stature, right? They will never reach it, but they are at least trying to get closer and closer. And the way to do that, there's 2 ways. One is to not do dumb stuff, right? One is to not Mets everywhere. To not be a calamity, a joke, a punchline, all of those things. The other way to do that is to win baseball games on the diamond. It is on-field performance. And for the first month of this season, the Mets were both bad and a similar joke to what they have been in previous seasons. That has changed in June. The New York Mets are 14-6 this month. They have baseball's best record in June. They have propelled themselves back into the wild card mix. They are outrageously hot. Their offense has helped them along the way. Meanwhile, the Yankees have really struggled. They have been scuffling. The bottom of their lineup is horrible. Yankee infielders in the month of June before yesterday had an OPS of 506. Okay? Yeah. Juan Soto, Aaron Judge, spectacular. No duh. The starting rotation has generally been good. Questions with the bullpen. But the Yankees were cold heading into last night. And that is the context for what was a fascinating affair in Queens. Gerrit Cole on the mound for the Yankees, making his second start off the IL, and he got his S rocked. Okay. Home runs off Gerrit Cole, 2 from third baseman Mark Vientos, 1 from Harrison Bader, and 1 from Brandon Nimmo. Mets take a commanding lead. Aaron Judge hits a grand slam in the 8th inning to trim the lead to 2, but the Mets hang on for a 9-7 win. Jordan, do you have any questions for me as someone who was there until the 7th inning?
Yeah, that's fine. So there's a lot to process in this box score. I was flying home last night, so I was not watching this live. However, everyone says, oh my God, Garrett teeing off on Gerrit Cole. Looking back at this box score, the thing that jumps out to me is not 4 home runs, it's 0 strikeouts. that is like, we've seen Gerrit Cole, you know, give up some homers. That's even at his best, you know, he can give them up. But four walks and zero strikeouts for Gerrit Cole, and I understand he's a little rusty. That's fine. I'm not saying he's doomed. I'm not saying he's the worst pitcher in baseball, whatever. Any version of Gerrit Cole getting zero strikeouts in a major league start is like very kind of shocking to look at. I mean, honestly, the fact that he even made it through four innings feels like an achievement, to be honest. And obviously, you know, with the Judge grand slam late, they make it a little bit more interesting.
I want to talk about Cole for a quick second.
Yeah, please. I would love, because that's the thing I'm most compelled. Big picture, I'm most interested about Cole here.
I mean, okay, so he's 97 in the first, and he's 93, 94 in the fourth, right? Mm-hmm. And it both super matters and doesn't matter. All that matters is that Gerrit Cole, when he picks up the ball for his first postseason start, looks like Gerrit Cole. And whatever the Yankees believe that they need to do to get him to that point, whether it is struggling in major league games, whether it is rehabbing him, whether it is giving him time off, like, that's the priority. Yes, they need to win the division. Yes, that's important. Gerrit Cole will play a role in that, but they are balancing those two things. Last night was a great reminder that he is not Gerrit Cole yet. That's not a surprise, right? And so Mike Petriello tweeted, it is not unconcerning that he's throwing 93. Yeah, it will be concerning to me if he's throwing 93 a month from now and he has no strikeouts a month from now. Sure. Last night was not predictable, but it was understandable given he was throwing 94 down the middle and like Mark Vientos is a major league baseball player who's pretty good and he can hit that out. What was more compelling to me was like the atmosphere at Citi Field last night. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had celebs everywhere, baby.
Really?
We had, Kenny the Jet throughout the first pitch. Donovan Mitchell took BP. Matt Harvey was there. Mike Piazza was there. Mike Francesa was behind home plate, lingering like the ghost of New York
Wait,
talk radio.
Did you say Matt Harvey was there?
Matt Harvey was there.
Okay. All right. That's all right. Fascinating. I guess he misses the Subway Series atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was an event. It was a scene, and that's what the Mets want this thing to be. And I think what my takeaway from last night is, are the Mets as good as the Yankees? No. Last night, however, was a glimpse at what Steve Cohen wants this to be, right? It was this high-energy environment, sold-out crowd. Now, granted, the Yankees fans coming to Queens helps that, duh. But it was awesome. Like, it was a great place to go and watch a ball game. And the Mets for seven innings kicked the snot out of the Yankees. Now, why are they good? Now, it's really not that complicated. They had a bunch of good hitters who were underperforming, some who were hurt that are now healthy, and that offense is rolling. The pitching is just as bad as, if not worse, as it was the first 2 months, and remains the reason that I actually don't have too much faith in them making a run deep into October. But given how mediocre the National League is right now, the Mets could absolutely make the postseason. That would not surprise me. They are in a spot, I believe, a game out right now from the postseason. And, you know, last night was just, it was just good ball. It was just good old ball.
Mets, game and a half. They're now only one game under 500. I agree with your assessment. I mean, I think a lot of the guys weren't even necessarily underperforming. But now that they're healthier, I know Marte just hit the aisle again. He'd obviously been playing well. But man, what Vientos has given them and then getting Alvarez back and then JD Martinez has been, it could not have been more exactly what you wanted, right? And having him miss as much time as he did, but you know, he's got an 863 OPS. Like, he looks exactly as he always been, even at age 36. So, but yeah, they have a lot of just really good veteran hitters. And that's where I am just like, listen, this is a situation where that's why I look at this. I'm like, how badly do you want to win? Because you have a lot of good players and there's a way you could build this team to actually, you know, be, you know, at least relevant in the playoffs, and now they might be just because the NL sucks, but I don't know. They're fine. They'll be in it. Everyone is a game out in the NL, so I don't really know what that actually means.
In the post-game presser last night, Carlos Mendoza, the Mets manager, was asked how his team has been able to maintain this offensive hot streak, and I loved his answer. He goes, it starts with having good hitters. Mm-hmm. It starts with having good hitters. Yeah. Like, yeah, nailed it.
Bingo.
No notes.
That's exactly right.
Jordan.
And they do have some good hitters.
Speaking of good hitters,
yeah,
you were in Boston, okay?
I was.
London of Massachusetts.
That's what they call it.
Went to Fenway Park, the Craven Cottage of Boston. Can you please elucidate for me the Boston Red Sox? Please explain them. They are on fuego right now.
Yes, yes.
What is this? What are we going to see on Netflix next year?
Hey, it's the same kind of thing. Honestly, there are some parallels with the Mets, right? You still have this ridiculously high payroll, but how badly are you actually trying to make the postseason? You have enough good players to do so. The difference with them, right, is why are they in this position? Well, it's because their pitching is excellent. But the reason why they have, and they've, you know, the pitching infrastructure has clearly elevated guys like Tanner Houck, who I'm writing about this week, guys like Cutter Crawford, the bullpen of anonymous guys, whether it's Weissert and Justin Slayton, the Rule 5 pick, and Zach Kelly, and Kenley's been really good. Like, the pitching staff is why they're there. The reason they're extra hot lately is because the lineup has been picking it up. Devers is just, oh, you know, he's been one of my favorites forever. He had one of the funniest home runs ever on Monday, hit another monster shot last night. And they had, you know, the game of the year, I would say. The comeback that they had, they were down 6-2 going to the eighth inning. All kinds of Blue Jays misfortune and horribly unfortunate mistakes from young players and just pitching changes, and everything was going wrong for Toronto. Ultimately, they did stop the losing streak last night. But Toronto is a mess, and Boston is just kind of riding it. And, you know, it worked out that the Celtics were there. And so, of course, you had that as the background, as like, of course, Celtics were in the building. You got to show out for them. But like, truly, you know, basically the entire Celtics team shows up, and the Red Sox are kind of not looking great for six innings. And they all stuck it out, right? Derek White's there, and Tatum, and all these guys are hanging out. And then they get to stick around and see this walk-off, probably the best win of the year that Jaren Duran was at the center of. And that was the other thing. I know we talked about Duran recently. But Duran's absolutely playing like an all-star. He's now top 10 in Baseball Reference WAR and F4. And that's because he's kind of just good at everything. He's been a better defender in the outfield. He's a fantastic base runner. He's hitting with enough power. He's at the top of the lineup. And they just have enough contributions here that if they can get Cassis back, and if they can probably add maybe one even, you know, fringe-ish offensive piece, they're gonna be in the mix here too. And honestly, even though the competition is better in the AL, I like their chances, I think, even more than the Mets to make the postseason. So, but we're going to see again with New York, same thing of things. How much do you really want it? How much do you really want it? Because you do have an opportunity here. I know they're not better than New York or Baltimore, but they're a solid team. And I hope that they push forward the next month.
Thank you. Thank you for the report. That's the Red Sox. I feel very informed.
Tanner Houck's awesome.
Tanner Houck's awesome. I think the reason they come back on Monday is just Celtics coach Joe Mazzulla wanted it more, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's that kind of grinder.
Yeah. He drew up a great, you know, out of timeout play. And then they scored four runs in the eighth and walked it off in the ninth. Yeah. No, it was a hell of a, and I will say notably, Alex Cora said it was basically the best energy at Fenway since 2021. So, which is not surprising because they haven't been, you know, that awesome since then. But no, I felt it, man. It was cool. I haven't been to Fenway in a while, and it was a really, really cool game to be at.
Best energy since the game where I got COVID for the first time in the 2021
a lot of energy.
ALDS,
a lot going on
there. Was good energy for the Red Sox, bad energy for my energy. That is enough of our field reports. We have a couple segments now, a couple topics that we need to talk about. I'm going to deem this a segment on Wednesdays moving forward, Jordan. Things that we need to talk about, the unavoidable themes, moments, motifs, occurrences percolating throughout our beloved sport.
Yeah, it's a good way to describe it, because when we prep the show and we're going through bouncing on different teams, there's some things where it's like, oh yeah, that happened. And then there's certain things where it's like, we need to talk about this. And so that is what we are going to do. Handful of topics here. Where would you like to begin?
I would like to begin on the riverboat perched very far away in center field at Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati, because Ellie De La Cruz, aka Steamboat Ellie, which is so funny, Steamboat Ellie hit a baseball 439 feet onto the top of the riverboat bar seating area at Great American Ballpark. You have spent a lot more time there than I have. I've been once, you've been countless times. I cannot remember a baseball landing where Ellie De La Cruz hit that baseball.
So it has happened a few times. I know people are freaking out about the distance only being 439. It's one of those things where to hit it up there just requires a certain kind of trajectory that, because it's kind of overhanging center field, it's not necessarily that far. Obviously, Cincinnati is one of the smaller ballparks. So that's why the distance isn't necessarily projected as far. However, there's a reason it has all probably happens once a year max. I think Corbin Carroll actually got really close to doing it last year. Adam Dunn had done it a couple times. And Ellie, I think what was so funny is that Ellie was asked, Ellie's interviews right now are just incredible. His post game with Jim Day, which he's mostly doing in English, is just so funny. And he basically was like, yeah, like I hadn't even really done it in BP, but they, you know, him and Jonathan India were kind of, you know, giving each other crap about who had more BP pop. And Ellie was like, oh yeah, okay, watch this. And yeah, I mean, he leaned on it, man. I mean, this is the kind of pitch, but you have to, it's not just how hard and how far you hit. Like you have to hit it high enough, because you see homers to center that are blasted, that are just lower, that are maybe even projected to be farther. It just takes a very unique kind of trajectory and batted ball distance and kind of hitter. And Ellie, obviously, once again, giving us unique things all the time. And that's what he does. And he's been great. You know, the Reds, and it's funny because O'Neill Cruz hit a 458 foot home run in this same game that nobody talked about. But that is that. I mean, it's cool that we have these Pirates and Reds, showdowns, at least for the next few years with these two guys.
There's something very tangible and understandable about where he hits this ball. Like if I were to go to a Reds game with a child of mine or a grandchild of mine in 20 years, and I pointed to center field where the riverboat is, and I said, Ellie De La Cruz hit a ball there, that is inconceivable from either home plate or from the outfield where you're standing. And to me, that is what I love so much about this. It is hard to conceive, right? And you had a quote from Jonathan India that was essentially like, I could not believe that he did this. So kudos to Ellie De La Cruz for the big old homer. Another topic Reds related that we just briefly need to touch on, Hunter Green vomited on the mound and then gave up a home run on the very next pitch.
Yeah, it's, you know, tough sequence. I think that we have now seen this a few times. Hey, it's hot out there, man. And I think Hunter Green said he had maybe overhydrated, which is, it's just a tough bounce, right? It's gross and sticky in the summer. You're told stay hydrated, right? Like that's what that is the first step of being in an okay state of physical being when it is very hot out, and then it backfires and it sucks. It's unfortunate for Hunter Green.
Jordan, when we were working at baseball camp in college, what did the head of the camp always tell the kids at the end of the day? When you get home, drink a glass of water. Hydration preparation starts the night before. Okay, you can't cram. I know Hunter Green didn't go to college, but this is not an exam. Okay. You gotta onboard yourself into hydration. Drinking a bunch of liquid right before you go into the heat and do activity, your stomach can't hold that, as we see on the mound. So Hunter Green, I saw someone describe this. This is maybe getting too in the weeds. I saw someone describe this as blowing chunks. I didn't see chunks. No, I don't think these were chunks. I think this is just too much water, a lot of liquid there. Hunter Green, hats off to you. We are always, just a quick reference here, we are always reminded whenever someone throws up on the mound of an iconic Division III baseball moment where a relief pitcher named Nick Bosma at Rhodes College in Tennessee vomited on the mound. Closer vomited on the mound and then proceeded to close out a regional game. So whenever we see someone throw up on a baseball field, Jordan and I call it a Bosma.
Hopefully sorry to Adrian Hauser. I know you want that street cred. And I'll ask for Hunter Green, you know, the start of his career has been a lot of learning, right? What works at the big league level, what doesn't. He is still so young, even though this is, you know, his third major league season as a full-time starter. There are still things for him to learn, and this can be added to the list. Jake, what is the next thing that we absolutely need to talk about?
I mean, the two best pitchers maybe in baseball pitched against one another last night, and I didn't totally notice it until the fifth inning, and by then it was too late. Tarik Skubal of the Detroit Tigers against Ranger Suarez of the Philadelphia Phillies went toe-to-toe at Comerica in Detroit. And the Tigers emerged victors 4-1. Skubal going 7 strong. Tigers getting to Suarez a little bit there in the middle of his outing. But, you know, I didn't admittedly watch too much of this, but like literally these are maybe the two best pitchers in the world.
Well, yeah, I mean, I believe they had the lowest ERA, or I know Suarez was definitely the leader before last night in ERA. I guess now he's still there. Hauk second, Seth Lugo still chilling at third, and now Skubal in fourth, Rinel Blanco fifth. Pitching is impossible to predict, but yes, it was a great contrast too, right? Suarez, we know the stuff has ticked up, but Skubal is on another level. I mean, Skubal he could start the All-Star game. I think he would have a very strong case to start the All-Star game. What him and Crochet, you know, and Hauk have done to really, really break out here. I just think the thing with Skubal, we talk about with Reagans, but like there was so much Skubal hype. I felt like we had tilted it too far in the other direction coming into this season for how good he was in the second half. But I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, are we really considering him like an actual Cy Young favorite? It's like, yeah, no, he is. he is out. He's better. He's even better than he was last year. So Skubal's awesome. Tigers can't really hit still, but they have a very, very, anytime he's out there, obviously they have a chance to win, even if they are playing the best team in baseball.
Last thing we need to talk about. There is some spice, some beef going on in San Diego. Beef, hate.
Let's put our Silky Johnson coats on and talk about Jurickson Profar. Jurickson Profar, he does seem to find his way into some stuff. I have to say, this is something that even as his, you know, on-field talents have been more mediocre over the years, he seems to find his way into some crap every once in a while. Now that said, now it's a different kind of Jurickson Profar, because now Jurickson Profar, who again already, you know, sometimes is likes to talk, likes to, you know, bother the other team. Now he's one of the best players of baseball. So now you're in a situation where he can retaliate with his performance and with his talk and smack. And we saw that twofold over the last couple nights.
Here's our timeline, friends. Join me. Monday night, Profar is up in a huge spot and hits a walk-off right after the Nats, I believe, intentionally walk Luis Arraez to get to him. That made Profar angry. And so during his celebration, he ran towards the Nats dugout and was like, you know, gesturing towards them. Now, he claimed after he was gesturing towards the crowd. I don't know if he knows this, Profar, but there's crowd everywhere all around.
There are a lot of other options over there for crowd to look at. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, when you're in that type of moment, you do out-of-body things and whatever, okay? Mm-hmm. It got heated. Fine. First at-bat yesterday, he walks up to the plate. Nats catcher Kyber Ruiz comes up to Profar, puts his hand on his shoulder, and is like, starts giving a little tisk-tisk, which is funny because Ruiz is, what, 23? You know?
24, yeah.
It's like a little tisk-tisk.
But this is part of the catcher responsibility, right?
Yeah. Right. Didn't seem actually too heated, but you know who thought it was heated? Spice God Manny Machado, who runs in from the on-deck circle, separates the two, and the bench is clear. There is jawing, there is baseball gesturing, but no punches or anything remotely that looks like a punch is thrown. Players are separated. Both benches are warned. And on the very next pitch, Mackenzie Gore, former Padre, nails Profar in the foot with a 98-mile-an-hour fastball. By the way, completely unintentional. Like, Mackenzie Gore is smart. He would not, like, he knows he's going to get ejected. Like, I refuse to believe he was intentionally throwing at him. Like, why would you throw at a guy's foot? Like, it was just a bad pitch.
The umpires
agreed. He is not ejected.
The umpires agreed.
All the umpires agreed immediately. He is not ejected. Padres manager Mike Schilt comes running out of the dugout. Why didn't you eject him? He gets ejected, right? And now we just have a very nice base level of spice that covers the game. Machado, next batter, goes yard. And, you know, Petco is just like middle fingers flying around. If you're a Nats fan there, someone's pointing at you, right? Like, it's just outstanding stuff. Like, everyone in San Diego's like, pretends that they're playing the Dodgers. We've hated the Nats for years.
Yeah.
We gave up too much for Soto, you know, whatever.
Right.
Then Jesse Winker, who the night before got into it with a Padres fan, gets booed coming up to the dish, hits a huge go-ahead two-run shot for the Nats in the third inning, and takes his sweet, sweet time rounding the bases under a hailstorm of boos. But that was not the final blow, because Jerks and Profar, a game-defining grand slam in the sixth inning down the line, and it's just pandemonium in SoCal. The Padres, yeah, this dude. Energy, this is the Padres energy that we want to see. They're packing the place. The team is playing better. This is it. Now, they're probably going to now lose five in a row, I'm sure, because that's what the Padres
that's what
do.
They do.
But this is, yeah. It smells right. This is what it's supposed to smell like.
I agree. It's funny that it's coming against the Nationals, but like, hey, we'll take it. Like I said, they were so bad at home over the first month and a half that to see them have all these walk-offs and just huge moments, and they go down and they come back, and like, this is what you need. We'll see if they can finish the sweep off later this afternoon before they hit the road. They're heading to Boston and Texas next. But yeah, and Profar, man, like, now, like I said, now he's in position to have these huge moments because he's hitting second and he's clearly figured a lot out offensively. And that grand slam he hit last night, man, I was, not that he hasn't pulled home runs this season, but visually I was like, oh, that looked like his first home run. Like, I remember the first home run he ever hit, which was, I don't know if it was the first pitch, but I believe it was the first at bat in Cleveland when he was 13 years old, or at least looked it. That way, when he was much skinnier, right? But now it's like he's doing that regularly. He has been one of the best players in baseball this year, and he will be an all-star for the first time. He'll probably start the game. And yeah, it's an amazing season.
He's the top NL outfield vote getter.
Tatis is hurt now. And so, I mean, Tatis might get voted in anyway, but like, he's definitely not going to play in it. And I wouldn't be shocked if he doesn't attend. So like, it could just be the Profar show as far as San Diego goes at the All-Star game. I know they might have a couple of their, I know Robert Suarez will be there for sure, but it's really astounding. And by the way, where is he going back for the All-Star game? Texas.
Which
Jordan, is amazing.
You cannot spell great hitter without hate. Let's take a quick break, and when we return we will talk about all of the bizarre goings on in college baseball. We will preview what we want the home run derby to be, and we will explain to you, the listener, why certain hitters have not homered yet. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Let's put on our graduation caps and head to the library because we need to talk about college baseball for like 5 minutes. Here are the two main things you need to know. Let's just, before we dive into all of the coaching drama, yeah, congratulations to the University of Tennessee.
We have a winner.
They won. The Volunteers, they raised their hand and they said, sure, we'll do it. We'll win.
We'll win the national championship for the first time in program history. Yeah.
The first number one overall seed to win the entire tournament. Since the 1999 Miami Hurricanes, this Tennessee team is going to be remembered as iconic. The game they won to take it all in game three against Texas A&M was spectacular. Dylan Dreiling, who won most outstanding player, he homered for the 85th time, it felt like. And then Hunter Ensley with the slide of the century. You probably already saw the clip, but to avoid the tag at home for the run that ends up being the winning run, Tennessee wins 6-5, and it is the culmination of a lot of very impressive work from head coach Tony Vitello. For people who don't follow college baseball, nowadays there really are, you know, two main conferences, the ACC and the SEC, but the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, is above all else. And it is a very crowded environment in baseball, even more than other sports, even more than football, just because so many baseball players are coming from that general region and so few professional teams are located in that region. So what that means is you have a very high level of play and you have a lot of fan bases for whom this is the baseball they consume. That pumps a lot of money into the SEC. And when Tony Vitello took over the program, I believe in 2018, it was a very crowded landscape. And he found his niche. He found a way to recruit talented players to Tennessee, who to that point had not been a particularly successful program in that conference, and he turned them into a contender, an annual juggernaut. Kudos to him. Hats off to the entire Tennessee team.
Yeah, they one of the great teams we've ever seen. They get to 60 wins, and they're going to have six top 100 draft picks next month, which is just outrageous. Dylan Dreiling certainly probably made himself some money over the last month. All those hitters could go in all kinds of orders. Christian Moore, a legendary postseason performance. And the SEC dominance is really amazing. Five straight SEC champions, five different programs. And the year before that, Arkansas was the runner up. And the year before that, Florida won. So that's really seven different programs either winning it all or being the runner up in the last seven tournaments. And that is an astonishing explanation of where the SEC is. And it's not slowing down for better or for worse. And honestly, it is a good transition to our next topic here, which is something that I think has broken into the mainstream, which is that Jim Schlossnagel, the head coach of Texas A&M, who just lost the national championship in three games, as they were also seeking their first ever program championship as a baseball team, despite great history. Jim Schlossnagel has been hired by the University of Texas to be their head coach. That has just happened within 24 hours of Texas A&M losing. It is they're having a press conference today, shortly after we record this podcast. So I'm sure we will have some more news coming out of that. But the reason this is broken into the mainstream is, I mean, the timeline itself is pretty shocking for sure.
However, his name is Schlossnagel. Yeah.
That helps.
Okay, I think that does help. If this guy's name was like Jim Johnson or whatever, it would stick less. But like when I was explaining this to someone yesterday, that was my first.
You're like, wait, what's his name?
This Coach Schlossnagel, like that sticks with you, right? Coach, also, he is a great coach, like very well respected. Coach Schlossnagel sounds like a, you know, bad high school coach, but shouts out to him for not being that. So yeah, this is broken into the mainstream in part because of his name, but in part because of what he said and what he has done.
Yes, yes. And so, I mean, we don't go through his whole history, but the point is he's obviously been a successful coach for a long time. He was at TCU for a very long time, and he only went to A&M a few years ago. So he's only been at A&M for a few years. Now, of course, A&M in the SEC, and so the TCU to SEC jump is like big. Texas is also going to the SEC starting next year. And so they let their coach go, David Pierce, who was very successful, but they wanted to make a splash going into the SEC and get their program back into powerhouse form. And they, as we will obviously find out, must have thrown a just gargantuan bag of money to Jim Schlossnagel to not only take himself to Texas, but also his entire coaching staff. That is very interesting, but I kind of want to put that somewhat to the side.
The buyout itself is $2.7 million.
Yeah,
okay?
But here's
so
the thing.
So like the buyout, I'm just saying, it's all freaking, you know, pocket change for the University of Texas Athletic Department. I understand that. And with the SEC money coming in, like I get all that. But just to put that into context, you know, I know college baseball doesn't have the same footprint as the other two
sports.
That's
what I was going
to
say.
But we are reaching that point here with the dollar figure. I mean, $2.7 million just for the buyout. I would imagine that he's probably going to end up making over 1.5 mil
Oh my God. Year. It's going to be over three. It's going to be like, 1.5 is like very basic low level for SEC. So, but I was just going to say, I mean, these spots for college football is way beyond that. So if you're listening, the buyout stuff is hard for us to comprehend as regular humans. But anyway, the point is, why is this a big deal? Because he was asked about this after they lost. Richard Zane, who covers the Aggies, asked him the question. I just want to read it word for word because this is very interesting. And I think the response to this at the time and then now since he took the job is very compelling. He was asked, with respect to the difficult outcome tonight, but with the rumor circulating today about a specific job opening, what do you have to say about your future in Aggieland? Coach Schlossnagel says the following. First of all, that's a fair question. People have been whispering about this for weeks. And so you have the opportunity to be a journalist and ask someone about something that everyone is talking about. That's your right.
And he did it. The journalist here does this in a very specific way that's very intelligent because they do not say the University of Texas. They do not reference a specific job. They give Schlossnagel the opportunity to say something generic, right? In regards to your future here at Aggieland, Schlossnagel could say, what an unbelievable year. you know, I don't really want to talk about any of the future yet. Like, there's a lot of emotions going on. That, we can address that moving forward. That's all it needed.
Instead, this is what it said. Quote, "I think it's pretty selfish of you to ask me that question, to be honest with you. But I left my family to be coach at Texas A&M, to be the coach at Texas A&M. I took the job at Texas A&M to never take another job again, and that hasn't changed in my mind." Okay.
Well, first of all, when he says I left my family,
that's like, I mean, that's the.
Did he leave? He didn't like.
I assume it was imagined again. We've seen. Well, this is also weird because he was coming from TCU, so he wasn't even coming from that far away. So I don't really understand exactly what that means. But maybe this is a mistranslation. But the second part is important here. Okay.
Yeah.
I took the job at Texas A&M to never take the job again. We'll come back to that in a second. But I think the second part of this quote is just as important. All right. This is continued. He says, "That's unfair to talk about something like that. That would be like asking Braden Montgomery if he's going to sign in the draft. But I understand you've got to ask the question. I gave up a big part of my life to come take this job. I poured every ounce of my soul in this job, and I gave this job every ounce I could possibly give it." Write that. Now, I think the second part, when I watched it for the first time, I was like, oh, he's gone. Like, he's talking in the past tense. He said, I gave this job my all. I poured every ounce in. And that reference to Braden Montgomery kind of has gone overlooked. That's a very strange thing to reference. I think the sentiment that he's getting at is this is an inappropriate time to ask about what is happening next when we are still dealing with the loss that we just had. That's fine. However, why would you reference something that is also definitely about to happen that everyone understands, which is Braden Montgomery signing in the draft? He's signing in the draft, right? Because that's what is going to happen next. So I also read that. I was like, that's a weird thing to reference. However, back to the first part of the quote, because that is the thing that he cannot necessarily talk his way out of. And what I'm most curious to see how he responds to today, which is saying, "I took the job at A&M to never take another job again. And that hasn't changed in my mind." That part obviously is very, the most basic reading is that's the most hypocritical thing that's ever happened to say that and then leave the next day. However, I have to imagine what was being left unsaid. This is not defending him because it seems like there's all kinds of ways that he handled this. It was not necessarily the best, but it seems like he was like, yeah, but that is how I felt. And now the situation has changed. So, but that hasn't changed my mind is a tough thing to talk around, I would say.
I want to remove what he said from what he did, right?
Yeah.
So he was offered a lot more money, presumably, to go coach at what is a program with a deeper history, no offense to the Aggies, like Texas has been to the College World Series more than anybody else. And the athletic director of Texas is his best friend, who he worked with at TCU, right? And so I understand why he felt the need to leave. There is no good way to do that, right? One cannot leave a school to go to another school that is the biggest rival of that school and now in the same conference. Like, people's feelings were going to be hurt anyway. So it is a difficult scenario, and he had to make a tough decision, and I think he made the right decision for his family, whatever. I don't fault him for leaving. I fault him for the communication about it, and I fault him for criticizing this journalist for asking the question. That is completely fair. If you believe that it's not the right time to ask, well, then when is, if you're leaving the next day, right? Should he have, person have called you in the morning? Like, that's what I don't understand. If you're going to jump ship, that's fine. But you got to face the music and face the questions. And the incredulousness with which he approached this particular question, I thought was inexcusable.
Totally agree. But as you started with, you could have still shrugged it off. You could have still, like, said no comment, this isn't the time. Like, he seems to be hinting at the sentiment that this isn't the time, except that he also says, I understand you've got to ask the question. So it's like he also is admitting that, like, okay, obviously they're going to ask me about this, but he just seems so angry that he thought that they would, no one would have the audacity to bring it up at that time, even though everybody had been talking about it for weeks. So it's really obviously the spice here now with Texas joining the SEC now, not that this wasn't already a rivalry, but it's going to be really interesting. I have one other thought about this, but go ahead.
My two final thoughts. College athletics is on a tape delay right now because in many of our minds, it still functions as this amateur experience. That is no longer the case. This is a money making operation now and has been for some time. That facade remains in, you know, less than it has in the past, but it's still there. And when you are a college coach, you are selling something different than when you're a pro coach. There's a deeper sense of loyalty, of community, of unity within your team, of getting everyone to pull in the right direction. And part of that is because for a majority of the players on a roster, they are not making money, right? The top end NIL guys are making money and a lot of players are getting scholarships. I understand that. But not everybody on every college baseball team is financially benefiting from the experience. And so you are selling something different. And whenever that sell is revealed as empty by the actions of a coach, it makes it a lot harder to swallow than like when Craig Counsell went to the Cubs, right? And so that is one thing that I am left with here. The second point, and what I really want to emphasize, is that as a whole, this is freaking awesome for college baseball. Because now there are people who never would have watched a game next year who will at least tune in or follow or think about the Texas-Texas A&M series. That is good. We have characters. We have interest. We have intrigue. And I have no notes on that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that's part of my last thought on this, which is just what happens next. And we are absolutely going to have more from this press conference later today, which maybe, you know, I'll hit on Friday. But the other obvious thing is, you know, we've been talking in college baseball circles for the last few weeks about the Texas job and who's going to take the Texas job and blah, 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 blah. Who's A&M going to go after, right? I mean, there's a domino effect here where it's like, it's not like A&M is like some schlub job. I mean, what happens with that roster is going to be very interesting. What happens with, you know, the Gavin Grahovics of the world, their, you know, their star freshman, who's still going to be supposed to be one of their best players next year. Some of their younger pitchers, they're going to lose plenty in the draft and they have a lot of older players. But just what happens next with A&M is even more compelling now, because now they end up trying to go poach some big name from some other school. And that becomes super interesting. So it is going to be a fascinating summer in Division I baseball.
The Texas job is probably a top five job. The A&M job is probably a top 15 job. So it's still pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, Texas, but again, like, they got work to do, man. Like, if they're going to compete in the SEC, but now we're getting into the weeds here, but that's, there is a list of stories, is just the beginning. And that is why we wanted to hit on it. And if you have any other questions about this process, let us know. baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. All right, Jake, we have one final topic. Let's talk about some home runs. The All-Star Game's coming up. How about that? And with the All-Star Game comes the thing during All-Star Week we actually care about. First the Futures game, then the draft, and then on Monday night, one of your favorite nights of the year, the Home Run Derby. And even though it's coming up here, it's, you know, less than 3 weeks away, I haven't seen a lot of buzz about who's doing it and who's not. I think we'll get that as it gets closer. There's a reason for that. Obviously, there's a lot that goes into the invites and, you know, getting permission from teams and all these things. However, I think it's going to pick up. And so we want to get ahead of it just a little bit and kind of preview what we think the Home Run Derby could look like.
Let's craft our field. And I think the best place to begin is with who's not going to do it, right? Let's cross some names off.
Let's crush some dreams real fast.
Aaron Judge, no, not happening. I think he's already said he's not going to do it. Juan Soto has not declined publicly, but I'd be floored if he did it in his free agency year. If he says yes, Scott Boras is going to jump in from the rafters and, like, tackle him before he can walk up to the plate. Fernando Tatis Jr., he is injured. He's certainly not going to do it. Marcell Ozuna has been incredible for Atlanta. I doubt MLB will put someone with that type of off-the-field track record on the national stage in a showcase.
Yeah.
Bryce Harper. Yeah.
The fact that he hasn't done it before, like, makes me think he's not going to suddenly do it now.
Bryce Harper, I will be in the All-Star game as a Philly for the first time. I just think, given his recent injury history and his back issues, I'd be surprised if he does it. Corey Seager.
Let me just point out. Go ahead. Bryce Harper did do it in his free agent year. Now, I know it was in DC.
Because he's a beast.
I'm just saying we have at least a minor precedent of that. Anyway, sorry, continue.
Yeah. And Corey Seager, who MLB probably wants to do it, also won't do it given his injury track record and his underwhelming first half and the way he's just kind of anal about his swing. I would just be very surprised. I know he's done it in the past, but I would be shocked if he did it.
Yeah. Unless he like really secretly loves it and will do it in front of the home crowd. I also very much doubt it. So who could do it? Who should do it? And who we think will do it? Where would you like to begin?
I want to begin with the hometown guy. There's almost always a hometown guy. And by that, specifically, we mean a Ranger, right? There will be at least one Ranger in the Home Run Derby. That is a given. Now, the obvious, I would say we should probably cross Marcus Semien off the list. I don't need to watch a bunch of 378-foot home runs to the pole side, respectfully.
I think he knows
what a player,
that too.
What a guy. Yeah. I think he knows that. That's fine. I want to see that ball go far. Three names pop up to me: Adolis Garcia, Nate Lowe, and Wyatt Langford. I think I'm leaning Nate Lowe here. Langford as a rookie, just it feels like the type of thing Wyatt Langford would be like, I don't want to, you know, overstep my boundaries as a rookie or whatever. Garcia has just kind of been meh so far this season, and I wasn't great when he did it last year. I think he's second most likely. Nate Lowe just is the right kind of energy for this. He's always clearly having a good time when he's playing baseball. Mm-hmm. He'll hit a bunch of pull side jacks. Nate Lowe feels like the most likely scenario.
I agree. And maybe it is Seager. I know Seager and Garcia. Nate Lowe, you know, he doesn't. I mean, Nate Lowe only is this correct? Nate Lowe only has two home runs. so that I know he was injured, but I assumed he would have been closer to like 10 or something. I'm sorry. Wait, this I'm just making sure that I have that correct. Yeah. So Nate Lowe only has two home runs. So that's not
tough.
That doesn't help.
Bad sell.
that's not great.
Hmm.
I do think
maybe
that
Garcia.
The energy,
then. Wyatt Langford has.
Wyatt, he has 14. Seager and 14 and Garcia have 14. Semien has 11. Josh Smith has 7. That'd be hilarious. And then, like, that's the thing. Like, oh, man, Langford would be so fun. I don't know. So that's, it's like, okay, so are we going to get a Ranger? We are probably going to get a Ranger. And Nate Lowe, whatever. I still think I would be fine to do Nate Lowe. If you think that's stupid, that's totally fine.
Let's give one spot to Natalis Locia. Okay.
Well, Wyatt Langford only has 3 home runs. Only 2 of them went over the fence. But I would like to see Wyatt Langford. That's my vote. That'd be most fun. Then you have, as we saw last year with Adley Rutschman, Pacific Northwest icon. It's oftentimes, it's like, oh, maybe we can actually make this the real hometown guy, right? And in this case, you got Bobby Witt Jr., who went to high school half an hour from Globe Life Field. And, you know, his dad played for the Rangers forever. And I know he wasn't playing in that ballpark. But, like, Bobby Witt Jr. is obviously going to be an all-star. Now, this is a situation where do you want, like, will the Royals let Bobby Witt Jr. do the Home Run Derby? I feel like yes. I feel like this is a situation where he can kind of tell them, like, I'm doing the Derby, and they're not going to tell him no. But I think that one's on the line. But I still think it would be awesome to see, and I think there's a decent chance it happens.
The next one is Gunnar Henderson, who said that he would do it if asked. Hey, Gunnar, spoiler, they're going to ask you, okay? I'm pretty confident that Gunnar Henderson, who is leading baseball in WRC, or sorry, leading shortstops in WRC Plus right now. He is a 178 WRC Plus.
So
second in homers with 25. He is the face of the baby Orioles. He is a superstar. I believe he's leading baseball in WAR, according to Fangraphs. That is true. Like, MLB is going to ask you, Gunnar, and he will probably do it. If the Orioles let Adley do it last year, they will almost certainly let Gunnar do it this year, barring injury. I think he is a lock. Like, he is the guy I'm the most confident in being there. So far, our list, we have Bobby Witt Jr., we got Natalis Locia, and we have Gunnar Henderson.
Langford-sia.
Langford-sia.
And then, speaking of guys that MLB is going to ask, I feel pretty good that they will be submitting a humper request to one Shohei Ohtani to participate in this year's Derby. Please, Shohei, please. Obviously, we have seen him do it once before in Colorado. It was very, very, very cool. He did lose in the first round to Juan Soto. He was gassed. Now, they were playing at altitude, so it was whatever, but he did put on a show. And they're obviously going to ask him every year until he's not playing baseball anymore. So,
they're going to ask him once he's retired. They'll be like, please come back and do the Derby.
I would love to see this. I think there's a chance. I'm kind of done predicting stuff with Shohei. Like, This is another situation where maybe the Dodgers would tell him, please don't. But I also think he still kind of gets to do whatever he wants. So maybe he, you know, wakes up, you know, the weekend of and is like, yeah, sure, I'll do the Derby. We know he likes hitting in Texas. That's another thing. I mean, he's hit some of the most ridiculous home runs of his career in that ballpark, even in, you know, since it opened. So maybe.
I'd love to see it. I'm going to put him in maybe.
I'm not ruling it out.
Good.
Yeah.
The other one that I feel really confident in is Pete Alonso, Mr. Derby himself. He clearly loves doing this. He clearly really cares about it. His intensity has been subject to quite a few LOLs over the last few years. But I think that Pete enjoys this experience enough that he will do it again. I think he will probably be an all-star. He's picked it up enough that he should get added. He'll be on the line. Either way, I think he makes the trip.
Yeah. Just to remind everyone, Pete wins in 19, beats Vlad Jr. Wins in 21, beats Trey Mancini. Oh, my God. Loses in 22 to Julio in the second round. And then last year loses to Julio again in the first round when Julio hits 500 home runs in the first round. So Pete's kind of regressing. So you could see this as like, you know, regressing. Maybe it's not my thing anymore. Or it's like, no, I got to reclaim my title. I got to come back. So
or it's like,
would not shock me at all.
Julio's not going to be in the All-Star game because he's been butt.
That's for sure.
So I don't have to worry about
that. I don't have to worry about Julio anymore. So I can go, yeah. I can go reclaim my crown.
So those are the four I feel pretty good about. Bobby Witt, the Ranger, Gunnar Henderson, and Pete. That leaves us with kind of four slots. What will MLB want? They will want Elly De La Cruz, yes. No duh.
In terms of who they're going to ask first, I have to imagine he's very likely going to be the Reds representative. He has transcended his small market to become one of the most popular players in the league. I went out for a drink after the game in Boston with Liam Fennessy. Shouts out Liam Fennessy, one of my favorite Red Sox follows. So and there was funny. Just a dude in there wearing an Elly jersey who had worn it to the game. And I went over. I was like, why? He's like, he's the guy. He's the hottest dude in town. He's like the coolest player. I'm not from Cincinnati. I don't have any connections to the Reds. I just love Elly De La Cruz. He's the coolest thing. I'm like, oh, yeah, exactly.
Right.
In Boston, like this is not a thing that you're ever going to see. That is Elly De La Cruz. That is why MLB will ask him. I hope he does it. Will it happen this year? I don't know. I wouldn't be shocked, but I'm not counting on it. I'm not counting on it.
He could switch plates just like Adley Rutschman did last year. Vlad Jr. is also someone who I think will get asked. He will be the Blue Jays rep in the game. He won it. Last season, he's the defending champ.
Yeah, so he...
Yeah. I think they'll ask him. I actually don't think he'll do it. I think Vlad is going to say no, and it'll be like, my team is too butt. I'm out.
I think it could go the other way. I think it's like, I am trying to do anything I can to have a good time. I think he will likely be the Blue Jays rep. Like, Vlad is not the issue. If anything, what would you Blue Jays fans want to see right now? Vlad Jr. hitting home runs. Vlad Jr. elevating the baseball. And maybe this will help him do that. He has already a legendary kind of... I think of Vlad is more likely than some of the other guys we've kind of put out to defend it. But we'll see.
Other names that we'll just throw out irresponsibly or responsibly. Josh Naylor, who has been spectacular for the Guardians. Kyle Schwarber, who... Yes, it's June, right? Like, he does this every year. His June has been amazing. I think he will make the All-Star team. Dodgers outfielder Teoscar Hernandez, Red Sox third baseman Rafael Devers, Yordan Alvarez of the Astros, Tyler O'Neill of the Red Sox, Ketel Marte talking about switch plates, infielder for the Diamondbacks. So I think those are all kind of like the second level of names. But I'm excited, man. I'm excited to see who we don't have on this list that will be in there.
Yes, right. Because we've seen some excuses made. All right, he's not quite an all-star. We'll invite him if they want to come. We'll see that. There's been a little bit more flexibility with that. But yeah, I think we'll end up with a pretty solid group. I would love to see Devers do it, but him and Yordan just feel like kind of too locked in on what they're doing in the regular season. And I will say the other thing about Vlad, I think we should mention, I know he's not a free agent, you know, after this year, but I think, sorry, same comp. It's not even that. What happened 2 years ago, right? Juan Soto wins and is like the subject of all the trade speculation. I think we could potentially have a very similar thing with Vlad Jr. next month if the Blue Jays keep playing like absolute crap and Vlad is their only good player. So keep an eye on that one.
Here is my half-realistic field. Okay. Pete Alonso, Adelis Garcia, Gunnar Henderson, Josh Naylor, Bobby Witt Jr., Kyle Schwarber, Tyler O'Neill, Ketel Marte. That's Jake's. Let me smell the future. Lick my finger, put it up to the wind. Home run derby field.
I think I feel good. I think Teoscar would be the one I feel the strongest about is going to be involved. But I think, this should be an interesting one. All right, Jake, that's enough about the guys who actually know how to hit home runs. We are going to finish this episode of Baseball Barbercast with a tradition, one of our favorite segments, where you go ahead and you sort the leaderboards by most plate appearances with zero home runs. Shouts out to Stathead. And you ask them a very difficult question. Why haven't you homered yet? And Jake has to stand in. If you have not listened to this segment before, Jake must speak on behalf of these players who have yet to hit a home run. Now, I will say, before we start asking these players these questions, there is a very basic answer, which is that there's not as many home runs right now. And the ball isn't traveling. This was a much more compelling segment when it was 2019 and 2021. The ball was flying like crazy. And it was like, how could you not possibly hit a home run? This would be very applicable, I would say, in the college baseball landscape right now with how much the ball is traveling in Division I baseball. But there are still players who have not hit home runs. And we must ask them the tough question. Jake Mintz, are you ready to be answering these questions on behalf of these players?
Yes.
All right. We are just going to select five at random. Here we go. All right. This player is someone I think we were pretty excited could maybe add a bolt of offense to this lineup that apparently hasn't needed it. Now he's back in AAA. But Kyle Manzardo, why haven't you homered yet, Kyle Manzardo? He's got his Cleveland hat on. You really need a Columbus hat on. But Kyle Manzardo, why haven't you homered yet in your 87 plate appearances in the big leagues?
Because I've only had 87 plate appearances in the big leagues. That's just not enough time. You know, coming from Tampa, where it's inside too, right? We came up with the Rays, and I had, like, mentally, as me, Kyle Manzardo, prepared to hit inside. Yep. And then they trade me, and now I need to play outside. Yeah, I mean,
a little bit colder.
You know how different inside is from outside?
That's true. It is different. Yeah. I would say it's like the opposite of outside. So that's fair. You know what? We'll give you a little bit more time. However, the next person I would like to ask has even fewer plate appearances than 87. However, it's someone that while power is not his game, at least one home run by now would be nice. DJ LeMahieu. DJ LeMahieu, with your 81 plate appearances, you are hitting 174 this season. More concerningly, you are slugging 174 this season. That means not only have you not homered yet, you have not registered an extra base hit. DJ LeMahieu, why haven't you extra base hit yet?
My foot. You know, so much of covering the Yankees, DJ LeMahieu, notice is my lower half and how I'm feeling. I haven't really been DJ LeMahieu since 2021. I believe, DJ LeMahieu, remember correctly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I missed the first couple months of the season. I haven't been right. And when you're hitting behind Aaron Judge and Juan Soto, you would think it would be inspiring. It's really just demoralizing because, you know, it's like me podcasting for Jake Mintz. Jake Mintz and Jordan Schusterman podcasting behind, you know, Meg Rowley and Ben Lindbergh. Like, we can't. How do I live up to that? You can't, right? And that's how I usually make you feel about hitting behind Juan Soto and Aaron Judge. Yep.
That's fair. Man, that is not going great. All right, my next one is a place where it's like, listen, I know, again, the power's not your game, but you should be getting some help no matter what the baseballs are. Jake Cave, who was traded to the Colorado Rockies right before the season, has registered 145 plate appearances with the Colorado Rockies this year. He's got four doubles. He's got three triples in Colorado. But Jake Cave, why haven't you homered yet? You're playing in Colorado.
Because I still think I'm on the Phillies. I spent most of spring training cozying up to Bryce Harper, hoping that if I ingratiated myself deep enough within the culture of the Philadelphia Phillies, that I would become untouchable. Unfortunately, that was not the case, and I was dealt to the Rockies at the end of camp. And you want to talk about a vibe switch? Gee whiz, buddy. Going from the city of brotherly love and the competitive roster that is the Phillies to the puddle of competitive irrelevance that is the Coors Field cesspool. It has been a shift. Yeah. It has been a shift for me, Jake Cave. And I do believe that all I need to do is elevate the baseball just a little bit and it'll go out in Coors. However, I am number one touch of gray king in baseball. Me and Lance Lynn, just for men, give me a call. Happy to get that NIL money.
There was that moment in the Rockies Dodgers game recently where the ball sailed over Jake Cave's head after a blown call and he was screaming at the umpire. Maybe he was just like, what was that? What did he just do? You can hit the ball over the fence? Is that allowed?
Two
more. The two leaders by a long shot. There are only two players with 200 plus plate appearances this season without a home run. And the second one plays for the Miami Marlins. And his name is Tim Anderson. Tim Anderson is at 225 plate appearances. He has not hit a home run. He also only has three doubles, 66 strikeouts, seven walks. Tim Anderson's fall off is one of the tougher ones to wrap my mind around. That's definitely a Marlins hat that Tim Anderson is wearing this season. If you're watching on YouTube, that is a very outdated Marlins hat, but not the one you might be thinking of. Tim Anderson, I know you only had one home run last year in a 524 plate appearances, so that's probably the answer to my question. But TA7, why haven't you homered yet?
Jose Ramirez knocked all the power out of me when he clocked me in the face. Simple.
It's just, all right, this one bums me out too much. All right, let's get to our leader. Speaking of the White Sox, Jake, our leader atop this Why Haven't You Homered Yet leaderboard, you could have guessed it before this season. He is a delightful gen. He is playing for his hometown team, but Nicky Lopez in 237 plate appearances has yet to hit a home run. Nicky, my guy, the pride of Creighton University, why haven't you hit a home run in 2024?
Because the Royals are my real home, okay? You thought, oh, he's going to his hometown team, South Side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of pressure, you know? I was like Anthony Volpe in Somerset, right? Everyone's right. Showing up. Thing. Everyone wants tickets. Everyone wants to say hello to me. And I liked Kansas City, right? It was like close to home. It's like people don't go to school, Jordan, in the town that they're – I mean, some people do this. Actually, a lot of people do this. But you and I purposefully – I mean, you and I – I mean, Jake and Jordan – purposefully left the town that they grew up in to go to school. That was me, Nicky Lopez, going to the Kansas City Royals. Now, I have never been a power threat, and this year is no different. And I just hope that I'm not judged for that. You know, I'm not judged for hitting the ball over the fence, that I'm judged for the person I am and the kindness that I exhibit to others. I got to say, Lopez hat off, Nicky Lopez, one of my favorite people in baseball, actually. He gave me a recommendation that forever changed my life, which was turning me on to Taiwanese sunflower seeds that he first tried when he was in Taiwan for the WBC. I now order them online, and they are awesome.
That's awesome. And here's the thing, Nicky Lopez. Right, it's unfair. Why would we make fun of you for not hitting a home run? Because you're unfortunately at the top of this leaderboard. However, let's end on a positive note here. Nicky Lopez is currently leading the league in sack bunts for the third time. I don't know how many players have led a league in sack bunts three different times, but I hope he can do that. That is the black ink on his Baseball Reference page. And as Jake adds as many hats as he can to the top of his head, I think that means it is time to end this here podcast. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for co-hosting with me. Thank you to all the listeners who have been so kind, sent us a lot of wonderful emails recently that we will be getting to. I will have a guest co-host on Friday, guest co-host TBD, so look out for that. Looking forward to that. We will be getting to more of your emails, which you can send to baseballbarbacast@gmail.com in the very near future. But we hope you enjoyed this episode. We hope if you're watching on YouTube, you are enjoying Jake trying to balance 10 hats on his head. And we're going to end this podcast before they all come toppling down. Thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you later this week.